I call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this February 15th, day after Valentine's Day. We all seem to have survived it pretty well. State's birthday. Back to business. Incidentally, if I get up and leave, it's not because I got mad at anybody. It's because I'm going to go testify on one of my own bills down the hall. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2319. Madam Administrator, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2319 comes to you at the request of the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists. It's creating the Mental Health Regulatory Agency, which would provide the administrative and regulatory oversight and centralized service for the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists and the State Board of Psychologist Examiners under one joint director. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if and when you decide to move this bill, this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. And Charles Hill and Larray Felton from the agency are here.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Greenleck and committee members. My name is Charles Hill. I'm the executive director for the Board of Psychologist Examiners and the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists.
Chair Greenleck, members of the committee, my name is Larray Felton. I'm the operations manager for both boards.
House Bill 2319 creates the Mental Health Regulatory Agency to provide for the administrative and regulatory oversight and centralized services for the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists and the State Board of Psychologist Examiners under one joint director. Each board will maintain its separate revenues and expenses through separate appropriations under one budget. The rationale is that the missions of both boards are rooted in consumer protection. The licensees of both boards deliver mental health services to Oregonians. The boards strive to provide excellent customer service to licensees through prompt, accurate, and courteous response. The board also strives to resolve complaints as quickly as possible without sacrificing a complete and thorough investigation. In October of 2013, at the recommendation of the Deputy Chief Operating Officer, Sarah Miller, the boards entered into an interagency agreement where they agreed to share management staff and resources while retaining their identities as separate boards. This pilot project was renewed for the 2015-17 biennium. 2 years ago, the boards presented the 2015-17 budget along with a report outlining the achievements of the pilot project. At that time, the legislature expressed interest in this concept becoming a more permanent solution during the 2017-19 biennium. The boards were asked to present a plan to ensure ongoing success, and that's what we're here to do today. Since early 2015, the boards have worked to craft a concept to propose to the legislature. We have coordinated with the Chief Operating Office, the Chief Financial Office, the Governor's Office, the Department of Justice, DAS, Shared Financial Services, and other stakeholders to ensure a thoroughly researched and vetted plan. Once this comprehensive plan was developed, it was approved by both boards by vote, and as a result, we requested this legislative concept, which has been introduced as House Bill 2319. Under the new Mental Health Regulatory Agency, we will be able to continue to improve efficiencies, simplify accounting processes, and streamline operations for the two boards who are seeing an ever-increasing volume of licensees and investigations. The volume of new licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapist licenses issued has been increasing by an average of 14.1% per year over the last 10 years. The number of LPC and LMFT interns registered increased by an average of 16.1% per year, and the number of psychologist licenses issued has increased by an average of 12.2% per year. The number of investigations received by the boards in 2016 reached 184. This is a 33% increase from the 138 investigations received just 5 years prior to 2011. Much success has been
That's
achieved so
board.
Far. Excuse me?
That's the two boards.
Yes. Much success has been achieved so far under this project, but there's significant potential to maximize efficiencies and better serve our customers through an established solution. Examples of some of the efficiencies. The boards are planning for a shared database administration. Note that we will ensure a firewall to for confidential information. Procedural alignment. Management will continue to review board operations and implement best practices. Administration of statewide mandates. We will continue to benefit from the expertise of shared management and operational efficiencies of scale. This applies to state reports such as information security plan and any implementation or reporting required to comply with executive orders. In conclusion, House Bill 2319 constitutes the board's plan for a permanent collaborative solution as requested. We hope that you will support our concept as we strive to achieve excellence in our services to Oregonians, and we believe that this plan will help benefit both boards by helping to keep license costs down.
Thank you.
We'll answer any questions.
Any question? I guess I have a question. You would maintain both boards, is that right?
That's correct, and they would remain their own separate identities. So
it would just be the management of the enterprise.
The administrative piece, yes.
We don't have, is there an amendment coming to this bill?
I don't know. I don't think so.
You have a proposal. We don't have any paperwork coming.
No, we don't, Mr. Chair. No, we don't, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing.
Sir, we have two more papers.
I'm sorry. Oh, what we got?
Kendra Morgan and Robin Henderson, two other people to testify.
Oh, two more witnesses.
Correct.
There we go. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
I thought you meant we had questions. Yeah.
Sorry
about that.
Chair Greenlick, co-chairs, and other members of the committee. My name is Kendra Morgan. I'm with Shangri-La, and we provide mental health services. And I'm just here to share a few concerns about this bill, and probably that would relate to the expense that it would take to create another regulatory agency in light of our state's budgetary situation, and whether that would detract funding that would go directly to support people that have mental health disparities. That would be one concern. And the other concern would just be that if there's already state and county officials that are over.
Would you explain what you're talking
about? Certainly.
I mean, these two boards would be run the same way they're run now, with the same license fees they get now, I think.
Right. So I am here to just express some concerns that I have. I don't know all of the implications that it would potentially have. And one of those would be the budgetary implications that it would have that would potentially detract monies from somewhere else. But that would also would potentially create another layer, and that we're not really certain how that would affect the mental health system that we're just trying to pay attention to, and just want you to take into consideration that sometimes taking these actions instead of looking at other ways of filling potential gaps can create unnecessary consequences. And that's all I wanted to share today.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today. I'm Robin Henderson. Today I am the legislative chair of the Oregon Psychological Association. I had the opportunity this afternoon over the lunch hour to participate in a work group with the Board of Psychologist Examiners and the lobbyists for the Oregon Psychological Association and the Oregon Board, licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists, members of the State Bar Association, And I think that was everybody we had in the room, but Representative Kennemer hosted that. During that meeting, we discussed not only this bill, but also House Bill 6319, and I'm going to miss the other number, but the one having to do with assessment.
That number is not right.
Okay. Oh, yeah, it's not right. 2319. Sorry. My brain's not wrapped in my numbers yet. But we had the opportunity to discuss all three bills and share our concerns that the Oregon Board, Oregon Psychological Association and the licensed professional counselors and marriage and family therapists and the unlicensed provider community had. And we came to an agreement to meet again with Representative Kenemer and work on an amendment to this particular bill to pull them all together into an interim work group and come back in the 2018 session with one solution for all three.
What's the problem with this bill?
The problem with this bill, we have no objection at all to continuing the pilot and bringing things forward the way that was happening in the pilot, and we're hoping that the redraft on this bill will continue to do that. Where we had concerns was with the overarching mental health regulatory board, and some of the language in there raised some concerns for us that we want to talk about more with the board and just didn't have the time to fully get through that.
I mean, we worked this process through. I don't think we're interested in putting it off another.
We agree with you.
If you have some amendments to this bill that are relevant to this bill, we should get them.
Yes, Chair Greenlick, we agree. And we met just at noon today and agreed to meet with the work group again to bring forward an amendment that moves this forward, along with then creating the interim work group that will fix the problems with the other two bills. So there will be an amendment coming forward.
All right. So I want to make sure I understand what's going to happen. You may have some amendments to this specific bill and a work group dealing with the other two bills. What are the other two bills? Is one just the naming of the psychological board?
No, this is the bill having to do with the assessment of fees for disciplinary hearings
and the
bill having to do with unlicensed provider practice.
Right. Okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay. But that might not affect this bill.
But this bill would be the vehicle. The amendment would include a vehicle for an interim work group. That was the discussion we had with Representative Kenemer today.
So they want to fix this bill with an interim.
So we can fix this work group and fix this bill. There's one small fix to this bill so that it aligns out with what the pilot was.
I'd rather amend one of the other bills to do that. Fix this bill if you have a fix to this bill.
Mm-hmm. I have no problem taking it back.
About the other two bills, put it in one of those bills.
We can work with Rep. Kenemer and do that, definitely.
Okay. As a provider agency, we can be a part of that work group. So,
good.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I have a question, actually. Thank you. So I was wondering, besides the fiscal impact, if there have been any concerns that you've had from the pilot? Because it sounds like this is just taking the pilot model and rolling it out as permanent.
Right.
So you mentioned fiscal concerns, but are there any other concerns you've had?
I think that the only other concerns that cropped up for us as mental health provider agency was just the potential of there being another layer of regulatory oversight when there's already state and county officials that kind of serve in that role, because sometimes that can complicate and make things difficult. And as far as
this bill produce another layer?
Excuse me?
Does this bill produce another layer?
I think that there was some concern about the way the regulatory agency would provide that oversight that could potentially complicate. Does that make sense?
Could I follow up? So that was my question, because the pilot has been going on.
Right.
And has that created an additional layer for you under the pilot co-housing, however you describe that? Co-shared services?
It's kind of complex because it relates to what she was referring to with the other.
And Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, that's not our concern.
Mm, okay.
Our concern is not fiscal or anything like that. Our concern is more nuanced in the structure of the overarching board that goes over the two boards. That's the specific area.
Overarching board.
And that's the specific area that we want to talk with the board about and how that's written.
But there is no overarching board in this bill. The same two boards, there's a joint administration of the same two boards.
And there's some issues in that joint administration that our two member organizations, the two stakeholders in this, the licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists and the psychologists, have some concerns about how that joint authority is spelled out in there, that are a little bit just subtly very small differences between that and the pilot that we want to fix.
Let's hear it. Okay.
We'll bring back an amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing. On House Bill 2319 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2388. What do we have, Madam Administrator?
I will let Rep. Nose introduce the bill to you while I get a pharmacist on the phone. So give me.
Rep. Nose.
Mm-hmm. It's fun to sit down here.
There you are.
Good. Yeah. You ready?
Welcome to AT&T's teleconference service. Please enter your access code, followed by the pound sign.
Do you have an access code representative?
I do, but I bet it's not one that works for that phone.
To join the conference as the host, press star. Otherwise, please enter your host password, followed by the pound sign. There are one participants on the call, including you. You are joining your conference as the host. For a menu of available commands,
Representative, please go.
Okay, well, I didn't want to compete with the,
You'll win.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is southeast Portland and a little sliver of northeast Portland. House Bill 2388 is a committee bill relating to pharmacy benefit managers that I am greatly interested in. This is a bit of a legacy topic or issue for me and for my district, as my predecessor, Representative Jules Bailey, first began working on this issue in 2013 when a dispute between Walgreens and Walgreens PBM made it impossible for him to fill a prescription for his wife. Now, before becoming a legislator, I had never heard of a pharmacy benefit manager, and I've been involved in healthcare and benefit development since the 1990s. In my time here, I have since learned that PBMs are entities that play a very crucial administrative role in the healthcare sphere by handling the payments due from insurance plans to pharmacies for cost of a medication after we pay our copays, and because of their involvement in negotiation price and because of their involvement in negotiating prices for drugs between manufacturers and insurance carriers. For those of you who don't know this, PBMs began as third-party administrators handling pharmacy and pharmacist claims so that insurance companies would not have to spend time and resources reimbursing the thousands of pharmacies and pharmacists they interacted with and the claims they submitted when prescriptions were filled. Given the sheer volume of prescription drugs on the market today, I could hardly blame them. Since their inception, though, these entities have grown and consolidated, and the influence of PBMs on prescription drug market has grown as well. I'm just going to go off my plan remarks for just a quick second. On OLIS, I'm told there is an infographic that I was given. I've only succeeded at printing it on 11 by 17 paper to be able to look at it, but it does a really good job of just sort of showing how the whole prescription drug thing really is quite complicated and the role that they play in this process. Now, PBMs also serve as arbitrators of what carriers are able to afford and carry with regard to drugs on their formularies based on the prices they negotiate. They're not just third-party administrators. So that's where House Bill 2388 comes in. Because of that growth and influence, I think there should be a clear regulatory framework that provides a regulatory vehicle for pharmacists and pharmacies if there are problems. I've submitted an amendment, I don't know if it's on OLIS or not, that I worked on with guidance that I saw from the DCBS based on a report that they did in response to a budget note that was adopted in the Senate in the 2016 legislative short session. Is it on OLIS yet? Can we get it yet?
We don't have it yet.
Shucks. All right, well, I'll just try to explain what I believe the amendment does at a high level. With the amendment that I'm seeking, pharmacy benefit managers would have to submit an application and register with the Department of Consumer and Business Services in order to operate in the state of Oregon. The amendment also creates criteria under which the license could be revoked. Revocable offenses could include things like falsification by the applicant or the licensee of an application, dishonesty or fraud, gross negligence in the transaction of insurance, or in the conduct of business as a pharmacy benefit manager. conduct resulting in a conviction of a felony under the laws of our state or the United States, conviction of any crime in the area of dishonesty or fraud, refusal to renew or cancellation, revocation, or suspension of authority to transact insurance or business as a pharmacy benefit manager or a similar entity in another state, failure to pay a civil penalty imposed by final order of the director, and I assume that's the director of DCBS, failure to meet the terms of a consent decree approved by a court or a competent jurisdiction in the state or something also made out by the director or pharmacy benefit manager, refusal to be examined or produce accounts, records, or files for examination with respect to the affairs of the pharmacy benefit manager, or refusal to perform any other legal obligation as to the examination when required by the director, or violation of any rule or order of the director of any provision of the insurance code. Now, that's a lot of legalese to basically say you're going to be treated a little bit like we treat any other regulated insurance industry in the healthcare sphere in our state, where there are certain regulatory frameworks and laws that you have to follow in order to do business. And I don't think this kind of regulation, it does not seem unreasonable to me. These are the regulations that insurance companies, really any company, has to basically abide by to operate and do healthcare work in our state. And I don't think at the end of the day there's going to be a lot of founded complaints as a result of this regulatory framework being set up. But I think given the influence and role of PBMs in the reimbursement and the setting of drug prices and in the distribution of medicines, it's more than reasonable for DCBS to place some rules around who is allowed to operate in this state and how. So with that, I hope you'll join me in supporting the amendment that I'm getting to this bill so that we can go forward with this.
Are there any questions? Hey. Yes, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and thank you, Vice Chair Nose. On line 12 or number 4 here.
Of the bill?
Of the bill itself. Yeah, I don't know if that is part of what you're amending or not because we don't have those amendments yet, but it says here that the department shall deny. Is it currently thought that the department, I mean, because they register now, is it currently thought like if that was spelled out there now would say may? Are we kind of changing a shell from May? Because don't they have the authority to do this now? And is this, or do they not have, in your opinion, do they not have the authority to do some punitive or corrective action currently?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, so that language was sort of drafted as a placeholder. And after I was able to read the report that DCBS did and what they recommend in the fall, I sought some of their advice. And the amendment that's not on OLIS, unfortunately, that I sort of read out to you, that's what they're suggesting would replace the language that you're reading. It's almost like we should just do a new bill, kind of. Yeah. So that you can actually, and then if there are concerns about what I just went through, all the various stakeholders that are sitting behind me or watching, they can sort of make some suggestions. But what I just kind of ran through is what DCBS thought would be clear and give them the authority that I think I'm seeking for them to have.
It's my impression that you've got tentative agreement from...
So in my short time here, I learned it's if you want to pass something, you try to get the consensus of folks that are involved. And so I have attempted to run it by everybody I thought that had a stake in this. And I know that some folks have some suggestions, but I have not heard any deep hue and cry unless I'm going to be surprised here in about 5 minutes. So we'll see. But I think I've got something worked out with even a few changes that should be fine.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to kind of a comment. Just thanks for bringing this forward. I think this is something that's been needed for a long time, and the PBMs have far-reaching tentacles than what they were originally designed to do. And, you know, like you said, they saw a good thing and jumped on it, and you can't fault them for that. But at the same time, there's got to be some control over that because it's gone far, far beyond its intended use. So I'm just happy to see you doing it, and thanks for stepping up and taking care of that.
Right on. I hope that's the last comment, right?
I think you You can come back and join us here.
Okay.
We have a few witnesses that would like to testify.
And they're ready.
You're going to start with the phone, huh?
We are. They're ready for you and for you to testify. Oh, okay. Mr. Chair. We have Anne Marie. Are you on the phone now?
Yes.
Oh, great. So Anne Marie is on the phone from Heppner, Josh Free, and Nikki Terzia. Get the gavel.
I got to share my own bill.
It's only a public hearing. Don't get too excited. Kelsey's
okay. Do you need to take over this for you?
Chair Nose, members of the committee. Thank you, Nikki Terzieff here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition. This is made up, members are both pharmacists from the practice setting within the health systems and also on what we would call Main Street, and then also long-term and specialty pharmacy. So we really run the gamut and get a lot of different perspectives. And one thing that we hear and one thing we understand is that pharmacy benefit management plans touch all aspects of those members and all aspects of pharmacy. So we have, just as a refresher, been working on this conversation for about 4 years now. The full bill, which was passed in 2013, was House Bill 2123, and it has been fully implemented for, I believe, over a year at this point. And we're starting to see the need for enforcement. So this bill, or I suppose the amendment that will be put forward and into this bill, is going to do a couple of things that will, we hope, ease some of the tension and struggle on Main Street pharmacists and specialty pharmacists when it comes to making sure that their clients' patients can access the drugs that they need and the prescriptions that they need. This should give the agency the kind of enforcement power that they have over every other registrant and over every other kind of sector or body that they regulate. We did a lot of kind of cut and paste, if you will, or worked in this work group over the summer to encourage that, and hoping to find that what they can do as far as the civil code goes, and fluidity and flexibility and investigation carries over here. So we want to make sure that bad actors, if you will, are dealt with. But we also want to acknowledge the role that PBMs play, and we know that not all of them are bad actors. And I think that this is going to get us into a great place. So we'll look forward to supporting the amendment, and Josh Free and Anne Marie and Heppner can talk a little bit more about why the need for this enforcement is there.
Vice Chair Nose, members of the committee, thank you for your attention to this issue. My name is Josh Free. I represent the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. As you may already know, and Nikki has alluded to here, this bill came about after a work group that met over the summer, where a variety of voices were heard around this issue. Representatives from PBMs as well as other stakeholders in the process got together to help arrive at what DCBS would need to enforce the existing law. And after some spirited conversation, as you might imagine, I think what came out of that work group is fair and would give the agency what they need to go out and enforce it. So there are a variety of issues that, you know, without going into all the details of what those issues are, there are a number of things that pharmacies need in order to remain viable as a business and to take care of their patients, and just transparency around the process and how drugs are paid for, and different things like that. Some reasonable restraints around auditing practices. These are all things that are in the original legislation that now we just need to be able to enforce.
Okay. Anne Murray, did you want to say something too, or are you just listening in?
Yes, I would. Chair Greenlick and committee members, thank you for letting me have this opportunity. I appreciated being on the work group this past summer. I was very impressed.
Anne Murray, you got to introduce yourself, even though we've said your name 3 times now.
Okay. Hi, I'm Anne Murray. I'm a pharmacist in Heppner in Condon, Oregon. I'm currently in Condon right now. My husband is also a pharmacist, and our family has served Morrow, Gillam, Wheeler, and Sherman County since 1959 as the only pharmacy in quite a big area. I got involved in 2013 with the first bill, showing how PBM abuses to pharmacies can drive people out of business and cause no access in these rural areas. I was glad to get to be on the work group last summer and was very impressed with how DCBS delved into this complicated issue and listened to both sides and came up with some good plans to help enforce this law. We really need this law and this amendment to be enforceable. Such things as below cost pricing continues to be a big problem for us. One example that you might be familiar with is Tamiflu. We've had a lot of flu this year in Oregon. In generic Tamiflu, I lost between $10 and $70 per prescription from December to February. That's a drug that you can't wait and call on and call the PBM on. You have to get it out and get the patient started on it within hours of symptoms. And I had to lose up to $70 from some PBMs on generic Tamiflu. We also saw a 10% change in price of generic Tamiflu from December to February. So we really need our insurance division to have the tools to be able to enforce the law that was passed unanimously in 2013. Thank you very much.
Okay. Are there any questions from the committee? All right. I'm not seeing any. Okay.
Oh, did you? No, I'll just echo Representative Pack's comments.
Duly noted. All right. I think Kelsey Wilson wants to testify on this bill. I'm supposed to call her.
You are.
Okay.
I'm just a backup, not the primary.
Thank you, Charnos, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelsey Wilson. I'm here on behalf of PCMA, the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, which is the trade group for PBMs. And I just want to echo what Nikki and the pharmacist said. Thank you, Representative Nos, for your leadership on this issue. We were at the table during the summer work group. We absolutely agree that DCBS should have regulatory or enforcement authority over the bill that was passed in 2013, House Bill 2123. And certainly if there are bad actors out there, they should have that authority to enforce the law. We have been working closely with Representative Nos. I think we're getting very close on his amendment and look forward to continuing the conversation and hope we can put this issue behind us for now.
Questions? All right, thank you, Kelsey.
Thank you.
Okay. Do I have to gavel?
Yes,
I should be paying better attention.
You should.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2388, and we'll bring it back up for a work session when we get some amendments.
Open it. Public hearing.
All right. Now I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2389.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2839. Did he?
Did I say it wrong?
Yeah,
we
said it wrong.
I apologize.
2839.
It was typed wrong. 2839.
All right, should I start over?
Well, you can just correct it.
Just correct it. Open the public hearing on 2839.
The bill comes before you. This was a committee bill that we introduced on the behalf at the request of Paul Turdall. This bill is prohibiting iBanks, tissue banks, procurement organizations, hospitals, or physicians from considering any disability of the recipient of that gift and from requiring that individual with a disability to demonstrate the ability to perform any major life activity. I don't have a fiscal or revenue on this bill, Mr. Chair, but it is just a public hearing. We have Paul Turdall, Jessica Bodie. And is Leif here with you?
Yeah, they're here.
Oh, are they still out there? Okay. Yeah. Please come.
Come on up.
He's in a wheelchair.
Okay.
But maybe they're not bringing him in.
I'd like to have Toby Brady from the Autism Society join us also.
Sure. Oh, Toby's at the bottom. Yes, please.
Going in whatever order you want, and just make sure you say your name and who you're with for the record.
Thank you, Vice Chair Nasi, members of the committee. My name is Paul Turdall, and I am live in Portland, Oregon, in House District 36. I'm here as a private citizen and an advocate for individuals with autism and other disabilities. I'm here in support of this bill for a number of reasons. What we have found are there are a number of situations where individuals with mental or physical disabilities have had difficulty getting access to life-saving organ transplants on the basis of their disability, both in Oregon and across the country. And there, in some cases, that's an explicit decision to say, hey, you're just a lower priority. We haven't seen that directly in Oregon, but we have seen that in other parts of the country. More commonly, there are generalized assumptions that an individual with a disability just can't manage an organ transplant, and so they are not really considered for that purpose. And so we'll have some testimony from Jessica and her son who have been through that experience here in Oregon. Several other states have encountered this kind of issue before and have actually passed legislation essentially identical to what we're looking at today to address this. In California, I think in the 1990s, there was a case involving a woman with Down syndrome who was denied a transplant, and after considerable struggle was able to get one, and it was successful. California passed a bill essentially identical to what we're considering today to specifically address that, and New Jersey had another similar situation a few years ago. This bill does a couple of things. One is it provides a very specific and straightforward rule prohibiting discrimination on the basis of the disability unless there's something about the disability that would actually make the transplant unsuccessful. And then I think also really important, it establishes an expedited judicial review process if there's a disagreement over how that is done. Currently you could sue under the Americans with Disabilities Act. This is a very simple, streamlined process for expedited review in Marion County Court to consider that question if a patient's life is in danger. In addition to what is here, there's an amendment that I would like to consider that you would like to work on drafting that would do two additional things. First, based on some language from New Jersey, it would specifically require consideration of a patient support system in determining their ability to comply with post-transplant medical requirements. And then the second is addressing age discrimination. Through my work on this bill, Representative Williamson told me about a constituent who was denied a transplant in Oregon solely because of his age and had to go to California where he was treated successfully. And so that is another issue that we would like to bring into this amendment. What I'd like to do is turn this over to Jessica to sort of talk about her experience. And then I know that we had some specific questions from some of the providers and some of the industry about how the bill was structured, and I'd like to address that or any questions that you may have. I would emphasize what we've got here is copied from legislation that's been on the books in other states for many, many years, and so if there are any structural issues, I would love to work with them to resolve them, but I think we're actually in better shape than they might realize. Okay.
So my name is Jessica Bodie, and my son's name is Leif O'Neill. And I want to thank you so much for letting us come here to tell you why we know that Oregon needs a law protecting its disabled citizens from transplant discrimination. Our story is important not just because it's one of transplant discrimination, because indeed Leif came perilously close, and I mean minutes away from dying in what we see as a very dark shadow of prejudice. But our story is important because he didn't. The light of acceptance and justice prevailed, and he became, to my and Stanford's knowledge, the first non-speaking person with autism on the globe to be granted a heart transplant. And I'm also here not just to say, yes, we need to not discriminate. I want you to understand how that discrimination happens, because unless you're kind of embedded in this, you might not understand. So one of the main ways that it happens is that people are actually denied evaluation. If there's no evaluation, there's no denial, right? It's not an official. So there's really they won't even look at your case or evaluate your case. And the second one that we encountered is that the denial of the bridge therapies. These are assistive devices that allow people to extend their life long enough to get a transplant. A transplant is a process. You wait. They're not just ready for you when you need one, right? So they're these devices that allow you. And my son was also the first developmentally disabled person to ever receive an LVAD, which is a left ventricular assistive device. So I think our story illustrates the need for accommodation during the transplant process, too. But really, more than anything, as he was talking about, is an efficient and time-sensitive mechanism for giving parents an opportunity to seek enforcement of the law. And I'd like to take just a couple minutes to tell you a little bit about our story and sort of how those things played out for us, you know. And our story began 4 years ago or so when Leaf was nine. He developed virally induced dilated cardiomyopathy, which means it came very fast. He developed a virus. Virus attacks the heart. Heart gets big. Once it gets big, breaks the fibers, can't get small again. It won't work once it gets small again. So in a matter of weeks, he went from a healthy kid, all but one very affected by a developmental disability, to a kid who was coming into OHSU, you know, Dornbecker's, critically ill. I think it's important to understand something about Leaf, that he, at this time in his life, we were going through a very exciting period. Even though he has profound motor planning problems, he has sensory disturbances, and the perseverative behaviors that go with autism, over a six-year period, he'd learned to type to communicate. And we were going through a very exciting time where we were getting to find out what he hoped, dreamed, wished, remembered, thought. We were finally getting to find out who our son really, really was. This is important because it came into play as to why Stanford accepted him at all, because he could communicate. And even though he appears so very disabled, he could communicate. He wanted to live, right? But the thing is that 2 years before, he couldn't communicate, but he was the same kid. And so while I think that that's an interesting part of his story, what it showed us, and we all kind of agreed there at Stanford, is that you don't know what someone's capable of until they're fighting for their life. He gained skills during this I never could have predicted. I never could have predicted that he would be 100% compliant, that he would show endurance and patience that exceeded most neurotypical adults, let alone a child with autism. He couldn't even sit in a restaurant for 10 minutes when this happened. I wasn't even sure he could do all of this, but I'm glad we went forward. You know, when we had arrived at Dornbecker's and he was in critical condition, they had told me that I would know everything they would know, and they would treat him like their own. It's a beautiful sentiment. I'm still struck by it today, but it just wasn't true. You know, we were treated by many compassionate people, but 5 days in, pulled into a room and told that two transplant hospitals, one of them in a state with a transplant discrimination law, had refused to even evaluate him, just right from hearing about his disability, and that it was unlikely that any hospital would feel differently. There was no moral outrage on the part of the staff. It was kind of like, this is the way it is. Go be with your son. It's a very limited amount of time. And we were presented with a horrible choice. Go spend every second with our son or launch a media and legal campaign, right? Which we started to go down that path. But he deteriorated so rapidly that we had to go be by our son. They told us the time was now. We had a few hours, maybe a day. We brought our friends and family. But there was one doctor that, not a senior doctor, not at all, who after his shift relentlessly and doggedly pursued the Stanford, sent, called them 14 times, sent them a video of Leaf typing. And at the 11th hour, and I mean 11:59 and 59 seconds, they opened their hearts and minds, and we were life-flighted to California. Coded the whole way down. They did not think he was likely he would survive, but he did. And the next morning, as he's on life support, a doctor said an important thing to me, which is that to them, the only ability that mattered was the ability to give and receive joy. And the next day, he was fitted with an LVAD, and again, was the first person with autism to ever be done that, which he rocked it, by the way. It is difficult. It's batteries and different things. And so, but what was interesting about that is at no time while we were here in Oregon did anyone even mention the existence of this technology, that there was a bridge therapy, that it could extend his life by years while we waited for a transplant. Mm. The presumption was he was too disabled to handle it, and we were never even told about it. So that's why I think access to the bridge therapies is equally as important as access to the transplant. Can't have one without the other. But really, the LVAD was kind of just the beginning of this sort of odyssey 5 open heart surgeries, a year in the hospital continuously, and eventually it culminated in this incredible gift of getting a human heart. What was great about what Leaf did and what they did there at Stanford is that they changed the discourse in transplant medicine from should we transplant kids with this kind of developmental disability to how do we transplant kids like this, right? Because now that it had been done. And I was heartened to see there was some language around accommodation in there, because that was difficult to get, and mainly because he was the first of his kind. Leaf's doing really well today, and at 14, he still remains a model patient, and despite how very affected by autism he is, I want to say that he might be the first person like him to be granted a heart transplant, but he definitely wasn't the first person like him to need one. Right. And so he has crafted a little statement for you, which I'm going to read to you. He's going to come in. He might type something for you. He's feeling a little nervous. He might choose not to.
That's cool.
Does someone want to get him? Actually, I'm probably going to stand with him. He types better when he stands, so it's okay. Mm-hmm.
While we're waiting, we're just going to add.
Sure.
Sorry, this is Paul Turtle again. Disability Rights Oregon sent in a letter of testimony about half an hour ago, and so I stand. I forwarded that to you. You can make sure that gets into the record.
Okay. I'm going to take my usual seat since the chair is coming back.
Hey, but so I just read them the letter that I told you that I wrote. And now I'm going to read the statement that you wrote, okay? Right? So Leaf says, thank you for making this law. Autism is not a disease. It's a way of being. We're the same, but different. And I want you to see me as smart. Kids with autism deserve to live. Death is just a new beginning, but I wanted to live. And I'm very grateful I received a heart. So, Leif, is there anything you want to add to this? You have a chance right now. T. H. A. Keep going. N. Take your time. Thank you.
Welcome.
Are you all done? Are you done talking? No, you're not done. What else do you want to say? Thank you. F. O. 4. D. E. O. I. N. G. Thank you for doing. It's okay. You got it. Thank you for doing. Go ahead. Hey, we're almost done. Let's do it. Thank you for doing. Go ahead. T. H. E. The. R. Keep going. I. G. H. K. K. Focus. T. It's okay. T. Be careful. You're almost done. H. I. J. And J. You're almost done. Okay. Finish up. You got this. You're almost done. And G. You all done? Thank you for doing the right thing.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Toby Raitz, and I reside in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here in my capacity as both the Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon and as the mother of two children on the autism spectrum, one of whom is also nonverbal. The Autism Society of Oregon is in support of House Bill 2839, which would prohibit discrimination on the basis of disability in determining recipients of transplants. The Autism Society of Oregon is the largest autism group in Oregon and the only one that operates statewide. We represent everyone affected by autism, including individuals on the spectrum and their families, across the autism spectrum and throughout the lifespan. Our mission is to empower these individuals to improve the quality of their lives through resources, education, advocacy, and support. Over 9,000 children are identified as having an autism spectrum disorder in Oregon, and these families access ASO as a resource throughout Oregon. The fact that a need for this bill exists at all is disheartening and seems to stem from a belief that people who experience disability, particularly those who are nonverbal, are unable to comply with treatment plans. There is no evidence to suggest that this is true for these individuals as a group. Nonverbal does not mean being unable to communicate. People who are nonverbal or non-speaking can and do communicate in a variety of ways, including sign language, pictures through the PECS, P-E-C-S program, computer applications, and through receptive language, as well as through the means that Leif O'Neill just did. Receptive language is understanding what is said and is distinct from expressive language, which is being able to form words. Simply because one can't speak doesn't mean they don't understand what's being said. There are sound medical bases on which to determine recipients of transplants or anatomical gifts. Disability is not one of them and should not be used as the basis to deny a life-saving transplant. As the parent of a nonverbal child who is in contact with many other parents of children with a similar disability, the most common reactions to hearing of this bill is, one, incredulity that it's even necessary, and two, a dawning realization that the policy as it currently stands has essentially determined that the lives of our nonverbal children are not worth living and certainly not worth saving. Excuse me. Nothing could be further from the truth, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
So, do you have any questions? I know, Chair Greenlick, you had a question about some of the specifics of exactly what was happening, and I think Jessica reviewed some of that. And as I mentioned, Disability Rights Oregon submitted some written testimony, which you should take a look at, which describes their experience with receiving many calls on this kind of topic as well.
The argument was there are a set of criteria that determine the receipt of an organ, and organs are relatively scarce, and that disability, the claim was disability, is not one of the factors that's involved in it. I was asking you if there was a lot of stories about instances where disability, in fact, was a factor that caused denial of an organism that otherwise would have been available.
And that's where I would really point to Bob Jundeff's letter, because he describes his experience with that on a number of cases. And I think we can, I know some of the other stakeholders, like Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank and others, had some concerns. And after, what I'd really like to do is follow up with them after the hearing and maybe talk to them, talk to Disability Rights Oregon to see what we can do to resolve their concerns. I think generally, as Jessica mentioned in her testimony, as Bob mentioned in his letter, nobody is really going to jump up and say, oh, yes, we have a policy. It's more a matter of, as in Jessica's case, simply never bothering to explain to somebody that it's even possible, or never referring them to the life-extending stimulus treatments that would be needed, or other kinds of things. And a major part of what 2839 does is it establishes it clarifies the basic policy as a note to everybody. Okay, this is our expectation, and then it establishes an expedited judicial review so that if there is an issue here, we can get expedited review just to get enforcement. There's no penalty clause in there. There's no civil penalty. It's just an opportunity to go to a judge and say, look, my son's about to die. Please help me.
trade.
I would like to add that I think that it's the algorithm they use does include the idea of compliance. And so it's usually framed not in terms of intellectual ability, but in terms of the person historically, how well they comply. My son is famous for his noncompliance. He could teach Gandhi a thing or two about nonviolent resistance, but when it came to medical things, he was. So I know they do frame it not quite so clearly typically, but in terms of like compliance.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important issue, and I think the principle is a clear one, that people ought not be denied on the basis of a disability. The argument is, well, they're not. We have this list, we run this list, and I mean, that's the argument. No, I'm not sure I believe that.
So the other piece here, and again, I was looking through the written testimony that I saw in all of us this morning and the statute. You know, the statute applies to not just the process of procuring and maintaining the list, but also to those who are using, you know, using, you know, the organs from that, including, you know, the you know, hospitals and physicians as well. And the, you know, you probably couldn't point to any one entity in there to say you, it's your fault. It's more a collective system, and this bill is addressing that collective system. And, you know, again, I hear and understand the concern about maybe like which section of this, the revised statutes this is placed in. When legislative council picked this section to put it into, they were copying what has already been done in California, New Jersey, and has already been on the books for many years there successfully. So my hunch is that when we sit down and talk to the associations that are working on this, they realize that it's actually not, you know, this will actually work for them. But I would really like to talk to them to see what their concerns are and what we can do to address them.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say I didn't know that this was happening in our community. So first of all, thank you for bringing it to our attention. If we have folks who need organs, and we have an organ that's available, and they're in line, and they're next in line, they should be the ones getting it. And so the idea that there's discrimination, that just makes me really sad to think about how many people who don't know how to navigate the system. You don't know what you don't know until you're living through it. And so I just want to commend both of you as mothers who fought so hard and are fighting so hard, and you're educating all of us. And I think that's absolutely commendable. So thank you for bringing this to our attention.
Yeah, thanks for hearing us.
Yeah, and we've dealt with issues of autism before. It's been very clear that a very large proportion of the members of this body have a near relative or a close friend that are on the spectrum, and I think this body is very sensitive to the problem. I assume in the disability issues we're talking about a much broader context than autism.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for testifying.
Did you get me? One more. I was in earlier.
Yeah. Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. And I just had a quick question on the bill as it's written, and it may be a legal question that you don't know why it's in there, or maybe you do. Is there significance of calling out Marion County specifically in here? I do realize that it says or other circuit courts from other counties, but what's the significant with regard to transplants with Marion County?
That was legislative council that picked that. So I assume they did that just for as a standard matter, of course. But yeah, I think it's, you know, if we were going back with an amendment, I can certainly ask legislative council what the reasons were and if there's, you know, if it needs to be so specific.
Well, yeah, I guess my concern would be if that creates any ability for some place to say, well, that's just what we do in Marion County and not the rest of the state. You know, I think.
I heard the chief judge of Marion County yesterday testifying how too many things come directly from Marion County because of the relationship with the state.
Yeah.
Well, they would probably rather not have it specified.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just wondered about whether that is important for some reason that we don't understand. And just on a quick note, thank you very much for bringing this very important issue, and let's get it solved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping both moms would still be up there, but I can look at you through here. Like many of us, Chair Greenlick mentioned, have autism close to our families. I have a nephew, and he too is nonverbal, does not communicate by speech. They have a lot to say, and they have every right to live long and healthy lives. And could you tell Leaf, thanks for being brave?
Yes. Absolutely.
I just appreciate that. I want him to know that we appreciate him coming and being so brave. And thank you for being the heroes and the champions for all of our kids. Couldn't happen without you, and I know the hard job that you have. So thank you for what you do.
We also recognize what a blessing autistic children are, but also what a burden
Amen.
They are to the family. It's really important to recognize.
Chair Greenlee.
I have my
own
family.
Depends on the day.
Thank you very much. I have a couple more witnesses to talk to hear from. Would you call the next panel, please?
Jessica Adamson and Michael Seeley.
I'm going to top that now.
I'll let Mr. Seeley be
there.
Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Mike Seeley. I'm the executive director of the Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, which is the federally designated organ procurement organization serving all of Oregon, southern Washington, and southwestern Idaho. I've been in the field for 32 years with organ donation and transplantation. I've served as an advisor at the federal level and had the honor to serve on the board of directors of the United Network for Organ Sharing for many years. I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment, and I also would like to acknowledge and thank the testimony I just heard by both mothers and their concern. This is actually an issue, autism, as well. It touches my family. And so I understand that. So I appreciated the testimony a great deal. My concern with the bill is the structure as it's written, as its intent may be incongruent with the way it's written. The bill references the Oregon Anatomical Gift Act, specifically the role of organ, eye, and tissue procurement organizations. It also assumes, as written, that these organizations have an implicit responsibility for determining the selection of transplant recipients. To be clear, these organizations have no role in patient selection. And I'll give you the example of organ procurement organizations who are explicitly excluded from the role as prescribed by the National Organ Transplant Act and are subject to the rules of the Organ Procurement Transplant Network, which governs the allocation of all donated organs in the United States. These organ allocation algorithms are firmly based in the ethical principles of justice and utility, essentially the principles of what's fair and what's the best use of a gifted organ. The balance of these two principles have been finely tuned over decades of thoughtful policy development with a strong foundation of public participation. The procurement group does not select the patient. The allocation system, in concert with transplant professionals, bear this serious responsibility. Because of the ongoing severe shortage of organs, and the fact that an average of 24 people out of the nearly 119,000 people waiting on the national waiting list will die today waiting for a transplant, the allocation system is designed to avoid discrimination while ensuring the stewardship of each donated organ. So in light of the fact that organ, eye, and tissue organizations, as this proposal links to the UAGA in the manner that it does not involve the selection of recipients or any role in that, and the fact that transplant professionals conduct services and programs under national policies with that oversight, I'm opposed to the bill as it stands because it may inadvertently harm our system of donation and transplantation in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
And that's Jessica, why don't you touch on them? We'll have some questions, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services. I want to start by sharing a little bit about the mission and the services we provide to the autism and those that are medically fragile populations. This is a set of services that are near and dear to the heart of the Sisters of Providence. Among the populations that they first began to serve were children with disabilities many, many years ago, 160 years ago when they first came to the Northwest. Today, Providence, through the Swindells Center for Neurological Development, we serve hundreds of kids with autism, both in the diagnosis and treatment, and helping that population be able to go on to live meaningful and full lives. In addition, we have the only Center for Medically Fragile Children in the Northwest, where children who are nonverbal learn to use their inner voices, learn to speak and provide through technology engagement with the world that is such a special and really moving opportunity for those children. We believe in the dignity of every life and in the ability for everyone, regardless of disability, to move forward and have opportunities and be able to succeed. And so with a very heavy heart, I'm here today to oppose the bill as written. We are concerned and would echo the many comments made by my previous witness, but we would also say that I think what we're concerned about is that we don't pass a bill that doesn't have unintended consequences. There is a very delicate balance in a system that we don't control through UNOS that makes sure that folks are able to use the organs, and that means that we need to take in family and patient support systems into effect, but there is a balance there, and what we're concerned about is language that would be overly broad and upset that careful balance. So we are more than happy to engage in a dialogue about this legislation and are there further concerns, but at this moment, the way it's written, we can't support it today. Again, that said, we are applaud the courage of the moms and Leif to share their stories today and the experiences, and want to honor their willingness to engage in this process. It's not easy, and we just really appreciate the work that they've been through and the challenges they've been through. We support the dignity of every life, but want to work to make sure that this bill in its current form has issues, but want to make sure that if a bill moves forward, it's one that doesn't create unintended consequences.
Questions?
I have a question.
Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Seal, Jessica, is there a way to sort of, I guess, enshrine a statute or in rule that says, no, you can't discriminate based on someone's disability? That can't be a criteria that you use blanket to deny somebody a transplant and still sort of accomplish what, you know, it sounds like to me your concern is, like, it feels very technical, like it's maybe in the wrong place in the statute, or we didn't use the right wording. That feels to me like that's not insurmountable versus, you know, a broader concern that I'm not sure how to reconcile.
Do you want me to start?
Yeah, go for it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nos?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Sorry.
You wouldn't gonna mess that up. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
No, I welcome the invitation to work through some of that aspect. It's like misplaced as far as who's responsible for what. And there is a finely balanced circumstance. And my experience over the years, too, is there's not blanket rules to say because of a disability they're ruled out. I can't speak for an individual practitioner who may have say one thing or another, but when it comes down to transplant programs, what I know of that is that there is a lot of thought that goes into that. There's a lot of oversight to prevent discrimination, and that CMS audits the organizations, the United Network audits them, and they want to be assured that the transplant programs are following their listing criterias very closely and as the policies and the standards of practice have been established. And if there are instances of discrimination, for example, that's addressed, that's you're audited for that, and there's a mechanism also to file complaint about if a person feels discriminated against with CMS directly. But the notion is this fine balance of care afterwards. If I might take the liberty to say that, I'm a little surprised that someone with autism would not be, initially considered or referred out, especially a pediatric case. Now, I know here in Oregon we don't have pediatric heart transplantation, nor is there a pediatric liver program, for example. There's a few positions removed from who would be the people actually looking at this and making decisions.
My real question to follow on his question is it your experience that a young person with autism, nonverbal, has an equal chance of getting a transplant as somebody who would be normal, if you will?
Chairman King,
my impression is it would not happen, but I don't know that to be the case.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm in a position, I'm not sitting in the transplant center's arena and what their challenges are. There's a lot that goes into the most important thing, how much can that patient be supported and the aftercare that has to happen. Transplant programs are also measured on 1 in 3 year survival rates. And, you've got to make those thresholds or you don't have a transplant program to serve the community. So I think a lot goes into that. Is it equal across? Obviously there are some people operating with different perspectives and who may be removed from the transplant programs and how they're operating. For pediatric heart transplantation, traditionally people go to Seattle, Stanford, to Denver, and down to Loma Linda. And that's how it's been. I would look to their experience. I'd also, I don't want to get off track of your question, but I hope that helps.
Well, just that I would hope that we could figure this out. It seems like, the folks that came before us have a very valid concern. I could see easily how discrimination based on disability could occur, even if people don't attend it, mm-hmm. right? I just think it's, and so having something in the process in the statute that says you don't get to do that, I think calls it out in a way. And then figuring out how to do that so that we don't, mess up the transplant process and how it's supposed to work. That just, to me, feels like something we can figure out how to do.
President Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. I think the testimony was pretty accurate in the previous testimony when they talk about the part of the ability to get the evaluation, mm-hmm. which may not have anything to do with your specific organization.
Right.
And so maybe the focus of the bill, perhaps the legal part or the statute that it's in, we should have a discussion about that. But I think there's validity to the part of the evaluation. I know from personal experience trying to get a certain diagnosis done here in our own Dornbecker's Hospital, I was able to get one test for my daughter called the FISH test, which identifies a gene delinquent sequence. But there's an additional test that tells us what that sequence is, which is much more involved. And I was unable to get that for my daughter here in Oregon, so we had to go to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, CHOP, to get that test done so I could have more diagnostic information about that. Now, this wasn't a matter of billing. This wasn't a matter of money or the availability to have that test performed for her. It was a matter of policy within that institution that we know what this general diagnosis is, and we do not provide this further evaluation. You know, in her case particularly, that didn't have to do with a transplant, but for many children with this syndrome, it does. It does have to do with heart transplants many, many times. And that evaluation process can be extremely difficult for parents to get if the health institution just says, I'm sorry, we don't do that, regardless of insurance or whatever. So I think there's a policy piece that may be missing here in the evaluation. I'm not sure who to bring that in, but children with disabilities certainly should have the opportunity to get a fair evaluation and not just be told, hey, as policy, we don't do that specific type of evaluation, or we don't do that diagnosis process to where they might for somebody else, right? And so I think there's a piece missing here, which was mentioned and very clear to me when I'm sitting here listening to it with my personal experience, with that the evaluation piece really needs to be tied into this, and not so much who is holding the regulation of who gets on that list and who gets the donor, but how do you get on that list, and the evaluation part of it, I think, needs to be a little broader scope. I don't have a solution, but could you comment to the evaluation piece of that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hayden, not being an expert at that, and you have a series of, in the entry in, for example, there's one test that's provided, but their policy was not to do another test. Those are a few steps with regard to transplantation removed, but would that need to be in the Anatomical Gift Act as a provision, or is there another place where it could be? Would be my sitting here, I agree with your question.
Yeah, that's my question. I don't know how you regulate
The transplant evaluation process is very extensive. Once you're at that place, when you get to the transplant center that will accept the patient or consider the patient, there's a lot that goes into that, and there's a lot of evaluation. But that's related to transplantation. I think you're speaking to a more global problem is where can we put that in place to get that attention to make that not have that service.
Just not be denied the ability to get the evaluation.
The Organ Donation Act, the Anatomical Gift Act, is might not be the place for some of that. I think there's some work that we could do working together that brings the issue I have about the procurement part doesn't have anything to do with the transplant selection, but there may be other mechanisms to say we want to keep your feet to the fire as far as
Mr. Sherrill
discrimination.
Is a very patient man in my experience. If you could get together with him and somebody from OHSU and somebody from Providence and RLC and find a way, I think you feel a lot of feeling up here that we ought to do something that symbolically deals with this question. And we've dealt with it before. We've dealt with disabled people not being able to get preventive services in a systematic way. This is not the first time we've been dealing with it. We've dealt with a situation of disabled people not being able to get other health services simply because they're disabled, not because they don't need them. So I think we'd like to see something happen in this regard. And I think we're not talking about tissue procurement. We're talking about the allocation of scarce organs and making sure disabled people have a fair shot at getting into that process. So if you guys could do something and get back to us, that would be really helpful.
Be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
you want
thank
to keep
you.
An eye on that for us as well?
Sure.
You want
to say me? No, I wasn't sure who he was looking at.
Who are you looking at?
I was looking at Representative Hayden, but
no, that's fine.
Would you like to be involved?
I would love to be involved.
Okay, well, let's get Representative Lamar. Lonzo Leone as well.
So I'll help you.
Okay. Not at all. One last thing, if I can share. Our director of clinical services, Dr. Jim Tuchman, in evaluating this bill, did say to me that one of the things that we should know is that when he's looked at the data and research, that he hasn't, again, through the screening, has seen that those with a disability that have received transplants, that they have equal or in sometimes better outcomes as those that don't. And so, again, in service to our mission and who we are and what we believe, a disability shouldn't be the sole factor that stands in the way of someone having access to these services.
Well, we've had training as a part of our orientation on implicit bias, and I think this may be a case where there is implicit bias rather than explicit, and we need to do something to even the playing field. Thank you very much for being here today.
Mr. Chairman, also, I mean, just along those lines, when we look at those needing organ transplants, they are disabled. You know, they're serving a group that are disabled because of end organ failure, and so that's in the core of the mission of transplantation. I don't mean to point out the obvious, but I think there's common ground there. So,
good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing. Can we go over here?
Yep.
Are you a computer?
No, it's just a note there.
House Bill. What is that? 2839. 2839. Close the public hearing. Is there anything else you all need to think about Friday morning? I hope you'll be able to join us. It should be a very interesting session.
Do we meet there? We meet there at the convention center.
Everybody's pre-signed up. They're asking me to get a head count, though, in preparation for lunch and seating arrangements. So,
yeah.
It goes all the way
through a legislative lunch at noontime if you can make it.
Yeah. Is staff invited?
Yeah. Some partners, maybe not.
We are adjourned.
Okay.
We are adjourned.
Okay.